previously.tv podcast network.
What's his thing?
I think it's a lot of bragging about his dick and drug dealing. That's what I think.
A notorious hip-hop murder cold case LAPD couldn't seem to, or didn't want to, solve. And a nefarious doomsday cult Australian authorities couldn't seem to, or wouldn't, stop. Evil flourishes when good men do nothing, regardless of continent, as Toby Ball and I take a look at USA's Unsolved and Starz's The Family in The Blotter Presents, Episode 47. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, previously.tv's take on all things true crime TV. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined once again by Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad. I'm sorry that you appear to have become our resident cultologist guest. Maybe you're not sorry about that. I hope not.
It's good to be useful.
It is indeed. We'll get into that in our cold case section, but first, our most wanted property. USA's Unsolved is a limited series about the attempts to reopen and solve the case of the murders of Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur. These murders, of course, occurred over 20 years ago. The reopening of the case takes place in 2006, I believe, where the Josh Duhamel character, and P.S., literally everybody is in this series. I think I might be in the series somewhere. It's so many "Hey, it's that guy" actors. It's pretty great. I enjoy it. But he closed some major case, and he's put on this task force because Christopher Wallace, Biggie's mother, Valletta, is suing LAPD based on testimony, I guess, from Russell Poole, who's played by Jimmy Simpson. Like I said, everybody's in this. Michael Beach. Apparently, Dwayne The Rock Johnson shows up at some point. So, Toby, how familiar are you with this case? Like, going into watching the first episode, which aired last week, did you know much about these murders, or just sort of what osmosised into your brain over time?
I think more the latter. I didn't know a whole lot other than they weren't solved and that there was sort of some sort of East Coast, West Coast element to it. And the first episode was not very enlightening as far as that stuff went.
Yeah, I think they're going to get into that more. I felt like they were doing a little bit of heavy lifting, trying to situate everybody in the case and sort of the facts on file, as we'll hear in clip two.
What do you know about the Christopher Wallace murder?
Biggie? Shit, everyone in the department knew about that.
It's been almost 10 years. RHD investigated it, led by Russell Poole. You know anything about him?
Yeah, I know that he thought the cops might have been involved. I didn't do it, if that's why we're here.
Wallace's mother filed a lawsuit based on Poole's claims. Now, it's gone back and forth in the court, but it's not going away. $400 million. That's what some economists said Wallace's lifetime earnings would have been. Testified to it.
$400 million. Jesus, I should have been a rapper.
I'd pay to see that once.
I think he'd be a really good rapper.
Yeah, no doubt.
Is he married to Fergie from Black Eyed Peas or something?
I think that's right. I guess we'll count that. Sure.
All right. Yeah.
Look, good for it. He's fine in this. We covered this crime on a previous episode, episode 22, when I was talking with Mark Blankenship about Biggie, The Life of Notorious B.I.G., which didn't really touch on his murder that much, but was a really good look at his art and his short life and what he meant to his genre of music. But it didn't really get into any of this stuff. And I was dimly aware that there was a conspiracy theory involving LAPD, which, you know, we've all seen enough like true crime about crimes in LA, whether it's OJ Made in America, whether it's LA 92, whether it's anything about Rampart that, like, I mean, it's not unbelievable, certainly.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to, there's enough evidence there from the past that it's, you don't have to withhold, like, why am I spacing on the phrase? You know what I'm trying to say?
You don't have to suspend disbelief. Much disbelief. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So basically the first episode sort of begins with, two guys jawing at each other at a stoplight. One guy is African-American and is blasting his music, and the other guy is driving like a El Camino and looks like a kind of typical Southland redneck. They wind up basically getting into a car chase. The white guy is a cop, as it turns out, shoots the black guy, and then it turns out the black guy is a cop, and then it's a whole thing. This is sort of like the kernel that is going to pop this conspiracy theory, and we'll hear a little bit about that in clip 3.
Can you believe this shit? Two cops. One's black, the other one looks like he should be auditioning for the goddamn Aryan Brotherhood. No good witnesses, no surveillance footage. We have a shit show.
Liger's interview was solid. If it's a good shooting, it's a good shooting.
You're seriously that naive? Who the hell sponsored you for RHD?
I'm not naive.
So you know what people think about the department,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're wrong.
Okay, so wait, because Gaines, he's going to be the victim, and we're going to be the white cops who are covering everything up, and good luck telling your kids how wrong everyone else is.
Look, my kids don't even... You know what? We do everything by the book. We'll be okay.
Come on. Where are we going?
Like I said, Gaines flashed gang signs in the car. Gaines was driving. He's registered to Sharitha Knight. Mean anything to you?
No.
She's married to Suge Knight. Checked.
Death row Suge Knight.
And what I want to know is why a police officer would be driving Suge Knight's wife's car.
I'd like to know that, too. And if all of this actually happened, this was new intel to me. Did you find this a credible theory vis-a-vis why these might never have been solved? Granted, we have like 9 or 10 episodes still to go.
When it was a police cover up.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell. Like you were saying before, like they're giving a lot of background, and I think they're also, they're sort of positioning Tupac and Biggie as being kind of buddies, which, you know, so they show that, but then there's also,
yeah,
they float this
and
theory
that
about
was,
how
that was true.
Biggie was revenge from Tupac being killed, so they killed Biggie. So that was a little confusing to me. But I think, you know, I in all honesty, I thought it wasn't too bad. Like, I don't know what I was expecting, but it moves along pretty well. It shifts back and forth between three different times, and
yeah,
it does that pretty smoothly, I thought. So I was, you know, I was impressed more than I was expecting to be.
Yeah, so was I. And I really can't get over the resemblance between this guy that they have playing Tupac and actual Tupac. Like a couple of times I had to like take a screenshot and then Google, like it is uncanny. And this guy has like 2 or 3 IMDb entries, and they're all playing Tupac. Like,
oh, really?
Yes. Like, just get in as many of these like series and looks back and reenactments as you can. Because
does he tour as like the Tupac experience and like play clubs and stuff?
I don't. I don't know if that's. I don't know if I would do that if I were him. I feel like that might be pushing it. Like Elvis.
Trouble. Yeah.
Yeah, the mariachi Elvis. Yeah, I don't know if I would go there. if I were him, but he really looks like him. This was true. Like initially they were friends. They were close. And in the life of Notorious B.I.G., they do sort of get into what happened there. That was like 78 documentaries ago. But I do recommend that. We'll have that episode and a link to it in the show notes. I think it was on A&E. But this is, I think, for a first episode that was really trying to locate us in the case in these three different timelines, I thought it was well done. I thought that maybe this is just how much like true crime I consume. And again, like not necessarily this case, but if you watch enough material about cases in LA in the last, you know, since LA was built, you kind of know already what the tensions are and what the challenges are for white detectives investigating murders of African Americans, particularly when Suge Knight is sort of like casting his shadow over everything. So I felt like some of these scenes were not necessary, but I do think that they're trying to lay groundwork for something like we hear in clip 4.
Kevin and I met out one night. He was handsome, flashy. Couldn't believe he was a cop.
No, we're not flashy.
I told him who I was.
Suge Knight's wife.
Suge and I haven't been together for a long time.
Okay.
Even before he went to prison, our marriage was just a piece of paper. Mm. I got my own thing going. I manage my own artists. Kevin even worked for me once.
What did he do?
He did security for Snoop at a family reunion he was having.
Snoop Dogg?
No, Snoopy.
I mean, okay, we get it. The, like, quote, unwoke detective of this pair is played by Jamie McShane, who was on Southland, actually. Great character actor. Always happy to see him as well. But they could be a little heavy-handed, sort of making Poole the sort of good guy who believes in the system and that he's going to crack this case and doesn't see race and whatever else. I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. I kind of thought that, you know, who knows what they're going to do with it in the next, you know, however many episodes. But I did think setting up a situation where, you know, there are people who are, you know, there's basically a system that's superficially concerned about race in a way that is just seems completely outward facing, right? It's just how are people going to perceive this? And then you have Poole who, you know, somebody calls him naive at one point, and I think that's
several points, yeah.
Yeah, which I think, you know, I think that's legitimate, but he is, you know, he's the only person who seems to really want to take any time to kind of understand what's going on. So I could see we're setting up that dynamic may have some payoff later, but yeah, it's not. They don't do it in a very nuanced fashion. You basically hit over the head with it.
Yeah. And I think especially another casting note, Mrs. Suge is played by LaToya Luckett, a.k.a. the other one in Destiny's Child. So good for her. Yeah, I think I'm sort of torn because I think that aspect of it is an important part of understanding this case and why it's still open, is that the spirit of community cooperation did not exist and probably still doesn't for good reason. That felt a little like, I don't know. We get it.
Right. So do you know how much of this is like actual? Like, was there like a task force put together to look into this, and or is this sort of the way what they're using to access the story?
I am not sure, and I was going to mention at some point that it's sort of a testament to how well built this first hour was, at least, that I wasn't Googling things.
Yeah.
I was just like watching and taking notes. So, yeah.
Because if it's, you know, if it's really based on something that actually happened, you know, that makes sense. If it's not, I mean, if it's a contrivance in order to, you know, quote unquote, investigate what happened, it's just the African American police who you see in this. I kind of thought it was a little strange in that you have the one guy who they go, who Poole and his partner go and meet, who had the case for a month and didn't get anywhere and seems kind of resentful, but also sort of, you know, he sort of is spiteful, but he gets backed down pretty quickly by those guys.
Yeah. And we actually have a clip of that that'll play in a little bit, but my impression, and I'm not sure this is true, but my sort of nebulous impression of Poole is that he's, you know, kind of a hustler, like, sort of this like a John Munchie figure who was also enjoying the attention that came from this. I'm not sure if that's true. I didn't read anything he wrote. But there definitely, it does seem like there is a pointed effort to paint him as a like naive and sort of a misunderstood figure. We do get this, car ride conversation between him and his partner in clip 5, which is a little heavy on the like character development exposition, and I'm not totally sure it's necessary, but I feel like it is going somewhere. We can talk about it in a sec, but here's clip 5.
You happy? It's the kind of case we should be working.
And we are. We're right. What's your take on it?
I don't know yet. Maybe it is just a gang murder, or maybe it's the whole East Coast, West Coast music war, you know, with the New York rap artists hating the Los Angeles rap artists.
Jesus Christ, a rap war. I should be playing golf right now, you know that? And do not call them artists.
They're victims. You can't forget that. I know it's easy to sometimes, but then this is just a job. I always prefer baseball to golf, anyway.
What?
Yeah, I used to dream of going pro.
It happened.
I wasn't good enough. So I did the next best thing and became a cop like my old man.
Sorry for us both.
I mean, look, Jimmy Simpson can handle this like weight of background information. And I kind of like the scene. It put me in mind of Zodiac. Possibly because Jimmy Simpson played Mike Mageau in Zodiac, and possibly because there was some soul on the radio in the scene. But they do seem to have a pretty good ear in this series for like actual procedural police work. And I find it satisfying as a procedural so far. But I also like he and his partner later have a big fight over how Poole has no life.
Oh,
and,
God.
You know, I've never heard you talk to your wife, da da da. And we heard in a previous clip that he's like, my kids don't even, like, I don't know what's going on there. And I don't really feel like we have to know what's going on there. Like, I don't.
Or care.
I don't need this to be SVU. I don't stick to the
yeah,
kids.
I mean, two things. One is, it seemed to me that scene was where they get into that brief argument in the, that was like, to me, seemed like the falsest scene. Like it seemed as though they wanted to have some kind of blow up to create a little tension. But it happens so quickly. Like it just escalates from nothing to this guy, like saying these really kind of, you know, potentially wounding things and then kind of storming off. And it seemed like, you know, they didn't want to devote that much time to it, which, you know, good, but I don't see
but then,
why they did that. Like almost all the stuff I thought when they were trying to sort of establish you know, sort of the outside of work personas for these guys didn't really hit very well. And but they didn't do very much of it. So that was good.
Yeah, that's true. And I hope that continues. But I would agree with you, that scene, which I didn't clip because I was like, eh. And then there's like a scene where they make up later and, you know, the way man bros do by, you know, not exactly saying they're sorry. I mean, okay, fine. But I do like, I'd like their partner chemistry most of the time. And like when they're in an interrogation room together, that totally works for me. So I'm not sure why they feel they have to do this, but I don't know. Like, I don't think, except to establish that the partner is one of those sort of, I wouldn't even say it sinks to the level of racism, just dismissive of hip hop as an art. And, you know, one of those, it's just noise dads, basically.
Right. And it's just like a bunch of thugs doing something.
Yes, exactly. Very, very dadly phrasing. Okay. So let's get back to that scene that you mentioned with Michael Beach as the cop in the Wilshire division who is having to hand over the case files to Poole. And I don't know why I can't remember this guy's name, so I'm just going to call him McShane. That probably was pretty close to his actual name. He is not happy. So on top of everything else, there's like a territorial issue. And the optics, TM, as there always are, in clip six.
So I guess you guys have had a change of heart, huh?
What's that?
Well, it almost makes you wonder, what if it was a white celebrity who got shot?
Christ.
Oh, Bruce Springsteen, one of the Backstreet Boys. How long would it take Homicide Special to take over then? A minute, maybe two?
You know what? You wanted this investigation, so you enjoy.
Hey, look, we should have been working this case since day one. We get that, but we're here now, so why don't you just give us what you have so we can do what Wilshire Division hasn't? After all, you have had a month.
No, you don't know what the hell you're talking about.
So tell us. We want the same thing.
Again, a little bit of a Mario Sue moment for Poole, but I thought this was good at sort of, oh, here's another challenge to this investigation, is that it's a hot potato in the police department.
Right. Go ahead. So that scene, you know, there's two African American cops who play much of a role, and the other one is who Josh Duhamel, like some old buddy who had a burner phone and got busted for it. So he's never gonna get out of the uniform unless Josh like puts him on this squad, this special task force.
He's basically the Lester Freeman of this outfit, so, played by Bokeem Woodbine. Always a pleasure.
So, it seemed a little strange that you're having if this is like what really happened, then fine. But that you have this investigation of, you know, two extremely prominent African Americans that's totally run by white dudes, is an interesting choice. But maybe that's the choice the LAPD made.
Yeah. Although, given how closely this happened after the OJ trial, you'd think they would learn. Like,
yeah.
Like, never mind that it actually is bad. Also, it looks bad to be like, all right, let's put all these white dudes on it and then bring in an African American, sort of belatedly. Okay.
Right, and they're so concerned about optics. Like, they talk about it all the time. But then it's like you've got the entire LAPD that you can choose from to have the guy who's going to lead it. And you get this, you know, get Fergie's husband.
Yeah. Who's like, he talks about his dick and dealing drugs. Like, well.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does. So, doesn't mean it's bad.
That's not the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if he's got a good cutter, he can make it work. Yeah. But I do like the show, I think, was trying to put like every, not every chip I don't know what I'm trying to say. I think it was trying to turn all its cards face up in the first episode, which was quite long. It was like, I don't know how long it was in TV time, probably hour and a half, but it was 55 minutes of like straight runtime.
Yep.
And I think they were just trying to like show you all the pieces and where they all are on the board right away, which is good, but it still left enough room for good like police work, processy stuff, which I always enjoy, and good interrogation scene where you really start to see how like this human wall, sort of literally and figuratively, that they've run into, trying to step to anyone who might be paid by or associated with Suge Knight, because they're clearly terrified of him. And that's our last clip in this section, clip 7.
I'll be honest, I don't like you for this murder, okay? But I have some questions here, and they're simple questions. I just need you to answer for
you. You took my car. Word is out. Shit's a target on my head, homie.
He just wants to clear his name. That is all he wants to do.
Fine, Keefe, fine. What'd you talk about with Biggie and Puffy that night?
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they was drinking, say what's up, how you doing?
Okay. And that's it?
Did you see anyone who might want to hurt Biggie?
I ain't seen nothing.
How about in general? Who would want to hurt Biggie?
Shit, you guys know.
No, what does that mean? What does that mean? Death Row? Suge? Suge?
Not saying nothing either.
That's the problem, is that nobody says anything. Meanwhile, people's lives keep getting destroyed. This isn't about Biggie being famous. This mentality has to stop.
This interview is over.
Oh, come on. We're going to have to talk to him again anyway.
He did not do it and you know it. Thank you, gentlemen.
Has to stop, Keith.
I mean, I still don't know quite what I think of that scene, because it's like, it does some things well, and yet it does other things very annoyingly. Including why does Jamie Hector have this accent? It's not good, and it's not necessary. Jamie Hector.
I had the exact same, and I don't even know. I can't like not identify him as the guy who is like the rival to the Barksdales in The Wire. Like, that's the only thing I can think of when I see that guy. For the most part, I thought the episode was well written. And I think, you know, it's a tough ask to basically put out as much information as they do in that first episode and not have it be totally annoying or just a huge like data dump.
Yeah.
And I thought they did that, you know, pretty well.
And it is a pretty big data dump, but they get it over. Like, these are professionals, and it almost, like, most of the time you don't notice just how much information you've been given in three different timelines. So.
No. Yeah. If I'd put that together, I would have felt pretty good about it. The other thing that we didn't talk about, but which I thought was actually kind of affecting, was when they're going through the night of the murder and the actual murder itself, and they kind of splice in some like actual like footage, you know, that I guess was taken on cell phones or whatever, at the time, and just they kind of walk through. It's not exactly minute by minute, but it's sort of step by step, like the party and then leaving the party and then driving away from the party and how all that happened. And I thought that was like, this isn't like a real tug on the heartstrings type show. And that didn't exactly tug on the heartstrings, but I do think that it made there's a little bit more of an emotional connection to that scene than I was sort of expecting.
That was extremely well done. And actually, like, actual footage of this murder, like, sort of the aftermath is really chilling. Like, there is just a lot of like screams of complete like terror and disbelief happening, that even though you can't really see anything, you know,
yeah,
what's happened. So I thought they integrated that really well. And I thought this, that sort of walkthrough occurs right after the clip that we heard with Michael Beach getting kind of defensive about having to hand over the case. So he's narrating, and then occasionally the robbery homicide detectives are like interrupting to ask follow-up questions, and they have to sort of go with the footage and kind of show the car, and maybe this car is black and maybe it's green. That was really well done, and to have those literally the pieces you know, laid out to show like, here's what happened when, here's who was involved. This car like blocked them and they got separated from the security guy. Like, that's all really important information going forward. And I thought they did a really good job of laying it out. Like when you start reading a true crime book and it's like, here's the personnel and here's where they work and here's who's in the DA's office. Like, that was well done. It's not easy to do without starting to, you know, making you start to wish you'd just read a book about it instead,
right?
Because it might be faster. But no, this was well done.
Yeah, no, I again, I was pleasantly surprised.
So was I, because I had been told I would get screeners, and then USA changed their minds, and I was like kind of secretly hoping that it would suck so that I could bag on it. But I'm going to keep watching it. It's good. It's a lot of actors I like. There's more actors I like coming down the pike. And I know a little bit about these murders, but I don't know this part of it, where it might intersect with LAPD corruption. And I'm interested to learn where they end up with it. Are you going to keep up with it?
I'm not sure. If I had oodles of time, I definitely would. Like, I do think it's, you know, if you're predisposed to liking something like this, I think you would. I just end up watching it between basically for my other podcast, end up watching so much stuff that like committing myself to another 10 hours of Biggie and Tupac is a tough ask. But
well,
this
is my one concern. Basically what's going to happen is what often happens with shows that I start watching for the blotter is that they stack up on the DVR until such time as something ends and I have time to just binge them in an afternoon while knitting. That's probably what's going to happen here. But I am also a little bit concerned that 10 episodes is like three too many for this.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to slow down. Like, there's no way they can do 10 episodes like that one where it's just, you know, where they would get that much information that they want to convey.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'll see if I can get my son into it. And if he's into it, we'll probably watch some more episodes.
Yeah.
The NCAA tournament's coming up too.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
So it's a tough moment. It's a tough time.
It is. I assume you noticed. And folks, if you follow us on Twitter or Facebook, that's at Blotter Presents, both places, you will see this in our occasional visual aids. It's this guy that Poole was just yelling at, Keefe D, with like 14 police guns on him, kneeling in the street and rolling his eyes. And he's wearing a Tar Heels hat. Oh, that's right.
No comment.
Oh boy. Yeah. I'm
Syracuse, not actually born, but definitely bred.
Fair enough. All right. Well, we'll get into that off the air. Listeners, let us know on the forums, previously.tv/forums. Actually, by the time you're listening to this, another episode will have aired. Let us know if you started it, if you're going to stick with it, if it slows down. Let us know what you think. We're always eager to hear from you. Okay, so when the murder of two future Hall of Fame artists is the pick-me-up of the episode, you know you've blundered into some dark shit, and that's where we're going in the cold case section. Okay, so I forget what prompted me to seek this documentary out. I think it was that 48 Hours did a special on this cult, which was called The Family. It's an Australian cult founded by Anne Hamilton Byrne. And her physicist friend, who is sort of barely mentioned in this documentary. But yeah, she basically was just like accumulating children, dyeing their hair various shades of blonde and red, like her own, and forming them into this, you know, idyllic, perfect, I mean, I hesitate to say Nazi youth, but it was a little boys from Brazil-y there.
Yes.
Meanwhile, the adult members of the cult, some of them were sort of more casual adherents, many of whom were highly placed in local and national government in Australia and in Melbourne. Others were aunties who enforced discipline when Hamilton Byrne and her husband were basically hiding in another country because the authorities had been called a couple times. Oof. I mean, this, I didn't know anything about this. I had heard of the family. I didn't know anything about it, really. I didn't even know it was Australian. I didn't know anything about this cult before I watched The Family on Stars, and now I can't unknow it. Like, I watched the movie yesterday, and it's just been like in my head, like a couple bars of music, but like terrible, depressing music.
Yeah,
good movie though.
It's really upsetting, quite honestly. Because of, I guess it makes the abuse. So this woman, you know, tries to create this sort of idyllic, like, family of 26 kids or something, who all have sort of identical haircuts and dress the same and stuff. But it's basically all of this is sort of enforced through, like, insane, sadistic discipline, which includes starving kids for as much as one woman says that the longest she went without food was a week.
Yeah.
And then beating them savagely. And I mean, we'll probably circle back and talk about how they kind of accumulated these kids, but quite a bit of it is interviews with these kids as adults. You know, they're probably in their 20s. Some of them are a little bit older, and it's so clear how damaged they are by that upbringing. So it's a very, I don't know, you feel like you get a very visceral sense of, the cruelty and sort of the legacy of this cult.
Yeah. And just the enduring frustration of journalists and law enforcement trying to, you know, move the ball, like get the Hamilton Byrnes indicted for something, get these kids into foster care to become wards of the state, which would have to be better. And yet there are still some people who believe in Auntie Anne's teachings and in her PR about how she, quote, saved these kids. We'll hear a little bit of both that frustration and this one idiot who's still in the cult in clip 8.
No one could see past the veneer of respectability.
When Mum and Dad came back from England or overseas was generally the time that they used to do filming, because of course we were all very excited and all very happy to see them.
I think we put on quite a good performance. It's a very neat piece of propaganda, the movie business. I'm sure it was designed to show people who Anne wanted to get into the cult. Why wouldn't you want to be part of this? It's, you know, it looks idyllic. You starve the kids, but you want them all for a film. So, you know, just tell them they're going to have some chocolate or something, and then, you know, you've got a nice, happy-looking family.
Anne's vision was for their betterment, totally.
A lot of the children were unwanted and had many, many mental and physical problems when the Anne took them. And then they got healed and redeemed.
Well, actually, sure. Anne took them by means of illegal adoptions, aided by the fact that adoption was very poorly regulated in Australia at this time, which was not like the 1920s either. It was like the 70s and 80s. And she could just...
Yeah, and she had like doctors and nurses who were part of her cult.
And I mean, there's like a whole mental hospital that basically she was running as an outpost where people were forced, children, forced to take LSD like every day for weeks at a time. This one woman was talking about how she thinks she lost like 3 months in this place.
It's insane.
I mean, it's literally insane. I mean, and when I say a doomsday cult, okay, well, we'll hear a little bit about this in the next clip.
She taught this mishmash of Eastern religions involving the endless wheel of life and death and reincarnation, and the bad karma builds up and up and up, and it's a bit like a toxic debt of a nation. It's actually so big you can never pay it off, so you have to have somebody to cancel it out for you. And she cancels all of your karma at the initiation ceremony. So the only karma you've got left to work out is what you were born to work out in this life.
We were brought up that we've had many millions of lives, and Auntie Anne promised us that this was our last life if we stood by her.
Only one rule: do absolutely everything she tells you. And that might range from what to eat, what to wear, what to think, who to marry, who to not marry, everything. Total obedience.
Ugh. I mean, I don't even know where to start, because that it did extend to that. They don't really get into, a couple of people mention in passing, whether she started out with good intentions and it just got perverted, but it seems to me like it got perverted almost immediately. That as soon as she saw that she could control people in these classic cult leader ways, that's what she did.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting about this documentary is that, in fact, I think you could have made like a 3 or 4 part series with the child abuse being one part of it. Because that's really where they focus, and I think that's appropriate because that's where the real crimes were committed. But there's a lot of other things that are kind of going on with this cult, including and in some ways it seemed a little bit like Scientology to me, and not just like the thousands of lives and, you know, having to like end the cycle, and you've got all this, you know, build up of bad stuff that you've done.
Well, yeah, and also we are like a chosen sect.
Right.
That will save the rest of the world, or clear, in Scientology's case, the rest of the world.
Right. But it also seems, at least the impression I got was that, you know, there's different amounts of kind of buy-in to it. So that you had a bunch of people. So one of the kind of weird things about this is that it was attracting like the elite, like these doctors and nurses. One of the first sort of people to become an adherent was a president of a university.
Yeah.
Who apparently had a lot of cachet. So I think there was this like larger group of people who would show up to, you know, quote unquote service and sort of somewhat be enthralled to her. But then you had like a smaller group that was the ones that were like, where she was like, you got to marry him, or you can't marry him, or, you know, you need to produce a baby with him, and when she's pregnant,
you have to stay with him,
you know,
even though he's beating you. Yeah.
So there was that, and then there was this relationship she had with the kids, which was it seemed to be in kind of a remote area that other people, you know, weren't completely clear on, other than like the real inner circle, who were all sort of helping with the abuse, I guess.
Yeah. Well, in our next clip, you hear, first of all, the like completely outlandish belief structure that sort of forms the foundation of her, like her pitch to people. But then at the end, you get the real sort of like, this is the executive function of how this works, which is basically, what's it called? Intermittent reinforcement, like just classical operant conditioning on people who are defenseless against it. That is in clip 10.
And I thought that UFOs would come down. That was one of the reasons for the perfect discipline. We wouldn't question, we would just walk straight into the UFOs in a file. When it was all over, we'd come down and we would tend to what was left of the world.
Ilden itself was very regimented, but at the same time very unpredictable. The rules could change, and you didn't know they'd changed until you'd broken them. It made it a lot more dangerous. You can't save yourself if you don't know what you're going to get into trouble for.
Yeah. I mean, this sounds a lot like what you hear at an Al-Anon meeting, frankly.
Yeah.
Just this, like, volatility, the difficulty of predicting anything. They also talk about how the aunties who are in charge of their, you know, abuse, like they called it care, would be able to sense when the kids were like allying with each other, and they would manipulate them against each other so that they wouldn't like, I don't think they cared if they bonded together. They just didn't want them to like be comparing notes and
right.
all sort of be on the same side and decide that this was bullshit. And meanwhile, even this guy who has been put, Lex DeMann, what a great name, who's been put in charge of this task force to try, after they did a raid on the Eldon compound, which is like 2 hours from Melbourne, to try to put together, something that they can nail the Hamilton Burns on. And he's working with a TV journalist, Philip de Montigny, I think his name is, who talks a little bit in the next clip about how there was just this like Illuminati level of involvement of family members in the government that made it impossible to get any justice for the kids or, you know, against the Hamilton Burns. And that's in clip 11.
I think that kind of nasty allegation, if somebody will come out with it, we'll take action against them.
Mm. It's been suggested that drugs are used within your group. Can you see any basis for this?
This, of course, I deny absolutely. We're respectable citizens, as I've tried to indicate to you.
After it went to air, the family approached Reg Ansett with a complaint. I got told in no uncertain terms that I had to do a follow-up, and it had to be a friendly one. We felt a strong enough case was there for an investigation to do with child abuse. We took all of our material to the Premier at the time. Because the judiciary were involved in the family, I got the feeling if I took it to the police, it would just disappear. Nothing would happen. So we took it to the Premier, and in fact, that's what happened. Nothing. It got swept under the carpet.
I mean, that's just so depressing. I can't imagine. There's a whole segment where, not this guy, but Lex DeMann and this guy Spence and other people who are working on this case for years to try to get these kids some justice or get them to safety, that like, you know, two guys quit the task force because they to like go to therapy, to go to intensive therapy. Others were just like drinking a lot, or their wives were like, you got to quit this thing. And I mean, oof.
Yeah. I think the emotional, damage done by to cops who have to deal with this stuff all the time. The place where I work did a study on basically the psychological effects on police who are investigating child pornography.
Oh,
where they have to spend a lot of time, you know, looking, you know, searching the internet and finding images of child pornography and the sort of psychological effects of that, of having that be your, you know, daily experience. So, well, like I said, I think you could have had more episodes of this that kind of explored a little bit more what exactly was going on that had like upper levels of government who are protecting the family, because they put it out there as being sort of a fact that they had to deal with.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. Like, it's not that I didn't believe that assertion. Although I tend to like fall on the side of, if it's a choice between, if, you know, wrongdoing has occurred and your choice of explanation is conspiracy or ineptitude, it's almost always ineptitude. Like, you know, but on the other hand, if it went so high that you're implying that the premier buried it because of family connections, maybe do a little chalk animation of who exactly we're talking about. Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I got the feeling that because they had all these, you know, quote unquote elites who are, sort of on the sort of outer circle, I would say, of the family, that it would be one of those things where people would make phone calls and kind and sort of quatch it. I mean, that was the impression I got, but I'd be interested in knowing more.
Yeah. And we were sort of repeatedly told that when, you know, when like child welfare came out to the compound, there was a system in place to react to that and to put on a show for the outside world. We have a clip about that we'll hear later, but your point that this could have been a like three or four part series is well taken, because there's also a whole section where they're talking about trying to adjust to life outside when they never knew anything else. And in some cases, struggling to like figure out how to parent appropriately. I think Rebecca is her name. She has a talking head interview that's quite affecting, about just talking about like being terrified that she was going to pass down what was dumped onto her
right. As
a kid. There was also that talking head interview about her taking out her rage on her cat. Which, I mean, she was clearly still horrified at her own behavior, but it's like, but you were basically a feral 12-year-old. It's like, you know, I don't like that you did that, but who even were you at that time? And then,
yeah, I mean, I think that's, at that point, you know, what modeling did they have?
Yeah.
You know, it's like you got angry, you took it out on something.
Yeah.
And it tended to be you. So, yeah, it seemed that there was a number. There was that guy who seemed a little bit older than the rest of them, whose mother maybe was one of the aunties.
Yes.
And he was talking about having his kids and about how, you know, he was going to be there. And like, he was basically going to do the opposite of what had happened to him. And I make it sound more flippant. It's, when he's talking about it, he gets very choked up, as they all do when they're talking about sort of the relationship with their kids and the trouble, the fears they had about it. And in some cases, the trouble they had at the beginning of like being able to bond.
Yeah. And just calling their parents, you know, or what passed for their parents. And then I think sometimes their parents were sort of like on one of those like medium rings of the orbit, but were convinced to give up their kids, or sometimes they were aunties, but one of them was calling. I forget who she was calling, but she was just like, I don't think I can do this. I'm not bonding with the baby. And then that moment that she finally had that breakthrough, it was like, okay, like I can actually be out here in the world with people who had functional upbringings. But like when they were all sort of pulled off the ranch, I guess, for the first time, here's clip 12 where they're just talking about how they're completely unprepared to deal with anything that's not the family.
Well, when I ran away, it was very difficult because we weren't taught anything about the outside world. I didn't even know how to cross a road. I remember going to the bank and asking them if I could borrow $50 to go and buy clothes. So, I mean, they must have thought I was really weird.
I really don't believe anyone really knew what to do. This was the first time they had a group of X number of kids coming out of a completely controlled environment and trying to interface them into the world. I was made a ward of the state, and I struggled. Failed HSC, got a job, got sacked from it. I'd been quite suicidal, very depressed. I was starved of love. You open doors to things in pursuit of that love. I had to be very careful that I didn't fall into another cult.
Like, that never would have occurred to me that that would be a challenge for a kid like that. But of course it is. And
yeah, this part reminded me of another documentary about a surfer family. God, I wish I could remember what it was called. But anyway, it's about this guy who basically raises his 8 kids as sort of a transient surfer family. And they become sort of some of them become champion surfers, but their sort of upbringing is so dysfunctional and so outside the norm that, you know, when they get old enough where they're not going to live in the van that they drive all over the place, you know, she's like, I didn't know what a check was.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have any of the sort of any social knowledge whatsoever. And I think it was the same with these. And then you add sort of the sort of emotionally stunted aspect of the way they were brought up. So, yeah, it's, you know, you don't get the feeling from watching it that any of them are doing great.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like some of them are getting by.
And then you have that Chiron at the end.
Seem tough
about one of them, who, you know, one of them who has been in a lot of the talking head interviews, died, like last year.
Wait, which one was
Sarah?
Who was that?
And then when you Google Sarah, who became a physician, but also like really struggled with just basic, like socialization aspects of life and still acting out maybe in like teenage ways when she was in her 30s. And then she lost a leg at some point. I'm not sure what that had to do with her time in the family, if anything, but you know, to a man and woman, they all say that they struggled with depression and, inappropriate behavior, suicide, attempts at suicide. I mean, it's rough. And you understand where that hopelessness comes from, because it must have been so clear to everyone outside and in that help was not coming. And we sort of hear about that in our last clip.
I couldn't believe that adults didn't know what was going on. The people around the lake would hear us screaming.
A couple of times police did come up. I remember at least once that we were interviewed by them.
The aunties were there during the questioning, and I do remember one question, and that was, are you being fed properly? Oh, I was surviving, I was alive. Yeah, sure, I'm being fed properly. You know? Well, how much are you supposed to have? You know, I had no idea.
I would never have dared to say anything at that time to anybody about what went on. We were all very protective of our parents.
I mean, you hear this a lot too. This, like, the imprinting that they have done on this horrible beach ball of a person. It's just like, they're not your parents. They stole you from your parents. They don't act right. Like parents are supposed to act. You're being beaten so badly you can't walk or sit. Except sometimes everything's lovey-dovey when a camera is on. I mean, that any of them is functional at all and has a family at all is like a miracle.
Yeah, they do. At the end, when they have sort of a somewhat extended scene with, I'm not going to remember his name, but it's a guy who sort of drank the Kool-Aid more than any of the kids, as far as you can tell. Like, he's very public in sticking up for the family when
yes.
they start to get into legal trouble.
Roland was his Roland, name in the exactly. family, and I believe he has changed his name because he's
yeah.
like, well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He goes and tries to find his birth mother, and it turns out that she's passed, but his, you know, birth aunt and her family comes to visit him, and they're sort of giving him sort of affection, you know, even though they don't know him, and sort of, you know, love without demand. And this is just in like the first like 15 minutes that he's ever met them. And you can just tell it's just such an exotic experience for him.
Yeah. He has this smile on his face. It's like a kid going in the front gates of Disney World, basically. He's just like, what is this magical place? There's so much candy. There's all these rides. But it's like just basic warmth and politeness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they're not snuggly. They're just being normal. And they're like, right. Well, do you want to look at these pictures?
So good to meet you.
And yeah. Then he's like, oh, you look just like your uncle. And he's thrilled. It's like, he has something that he feels a part of that. Like, of course he does. It's everyone wants that. Everyone wants to belong to something. And I don't know. I mean, what is he, our age? I don't know how old you are, but I think he's probably close to my age, and he's just like, and he looks like an 8-year-old, just so happy, yeah. Which I was thrilled for him, but it was also like, oh my God. Plus he looks a little like one of my cousins. So that was making me a little depressed. And I was like, oh God, great. Paul, why didn't you tell a grown up? Just kidding. My aunt and uncle were fine. Yeah. This, I forget the listener who recommended that I check this out on Twitter. Thank you, I think, but I will recommend this movie. It's well made, but it is a lot. Like, it's an hour and 40 minutes of pretty unrelenting bleakness. And yeah. But once again, something that it was like, okay, I am held. My attention is held by this. I'm not Googling anything. I'm waiting to see.
Right.
What they tell me.
Yeah. I mean, it's well made. The story, I think, particularly in Australia, probably where you're sort of more aware of it, you know, probably in a passing way without knowing all the details, maybe. So I think that, you know, the trigger warning would be like 2 pages long.
Yeah. Because
there's just all kinds of stuff. And so if you don't want to watch something that's absolutely, it's depressing, the moments of lightness, I think we just talked about the only one.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really bleak. And I guess my only other criticism of it is, you know, I kind of feel like if I'm going to sit through something that's that much of a downer, it's like, what do you end up taking away from it? You know, what is it, you know, how is it changing the way I think about things?
Yeah.
And I just didn't feel that with this. You know, I kind of felt like, This was, another story about, manipulation and things like that. But then included this sort of unbelievable cruelty. And it was just hard for me to figure out what it was when it was over.
There's not a satisfying thing. Like, Anne is not set on fire by anyone, which would be the like emotional catharsis that you might hope for. Certainly I was hoping for, at the end of this, are most of the kids just sort of like continuing to struggle and be in the world? Sure. Yes. That's hopeful, but it's a definite struggle for them. And I see what you mean. Like, on top of the fact that I think maybe breaking this up into, more and smaller chunks, just because there's a lot of material and it's a lot, and maybe it's like, maybe we don't do all this at once. Maybe we do it over a few weeks. But yeah, it's, I don't know. Like, there's not that moment at the end where you're like, okay, and the darkest hour is just before dawn. Here's the dawn at the end. It's not really, it's all dark. It's all pretty dark.
Did you see The Keepers?
Oh God. Yes, I did.
So I kind of felt like, so this is in some ways a little bit similar. But I thought what The Keepers did more effectively was sort of show how power structures, enable like these sort of individual sadists to continue doing what they're doing. And again, I think if you'd had been able to go on for longer, you could have probably made points about that, because it's sort of hinted at, and I guess mentioned in as sort of an obstacle, but without getting very far into it. So I don't. Yeah, I mean,
well,
I think
you also have Gene Hargadon in The Keepers, who is like this beacon of, I don't know, like, she just won't, they kept just trying to make her stay down and she wouldn't. And there was something about, not to be cheesy, about the indomitability of the human spirit, but there's absolutely something about this little woman with her Baltimore accent that she's just like, and often sobbing on camera, but also refusing to back off of this so that someone else might get something out of it. I'm not sure you see that here.
Yeah.
But now let me ask you this. Am I thinking of another country, or is Scientology like illegal in Australia? Where am I thinking?
I know it's illegal in Germany.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know about Australia.
Yeah, I must be thinking of Germany, but it's like, because I was thinking, like, if Scientology is illegal in Australia, I bet it's because of this.
Yeah,
absolutely. The Family, it's on Stars. I think it's on there on demand, like on the app and whatnot, for like another week till the 12th. And in the meantime, I think the 48 Hours archives have a probably slightly less, soul deadening version, of the story on their website. And we will link to that in the show notes. But yeah, like, I recommend this, but I don't know, be near a pet or a loved one and, have something to look forward to after it that makes you feel good about humanity, because this is not going to do that for you.
And if you feel like any of this conversation is like, I might be triggered by this, or I might find this too depressing, then yes, don't watch it.
Yeah. Like,
it's all this and more.
Yeah. Like, this is all we like do for our podcasts all week. And we're still both like, oof. So yeah, it's heavy stuff, but it's well done. So that is my recommendation. Speaking of which, I highly recommend Toby Ball's regular gig in podcast world, Crime Writers On. Toby, where else can listeners find you or read your works?
So I have three sort of crime suspense novels, The Vault, Scorched City, and Invisible Streets, which are all available at your favorite online bookstore, and Crime Writers On. And I guess that's kind of about it. Oh, at Toby Ball NH on Twitter.
Thank you very much for joining us again. I would say that I'll pick out something more cheery for your next guest appearance, but it's The Blotter Presents. Well, probably not going to happen.
The bar's pretty low at the moment.
Okay. It really is. Next time on The Blotter Presents, we'll be taking a look at The Golden State Killer via Investigation Discovery and via Michelle McNamara's book, which finally hit my doorstep last week. Our guest will be Mike Dunn. In future episodes, we'll be looking at Trust, Operation Odessa, and many other fine vintage properties of a true crime persuasion. Got something to add to The Blotter Presents case files? Visit our forums at previously.tv/forums or hit me on social media at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. My guest was Toby Ball. You can hear him on Crime Writers On and find him on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. We'll talk to you next time.
Been a production of the Previously.tv podcast network.